a condensed matter physicist, a statistical mechanic, and I'm going to be talking to you about the fundamentals of statistical physics. Now, statistical physics is not precisely the same as statistical mechanics. Statistical mechanics is an equilibrium thing, requires letting stuff sit and wait forever. And then when it settles down, you have an equilibrium description in terms of a Hamiltonian. That description turns out to be very similar to the description of quantum field theory, if you look at it in the right way. Then, in addition, there are problems of dynamics. Statistical mechanics is how things come to, what happens after things come to equilibrium. Dynamics includes all kinds of time dependence as described in a statistical manner. You learn about all kinds of different things that happen in the world. This is very orderly. It has a considerable similarity with Lagrangian mechanics. This is disorderly. Everything in the world can happen. There's all kinds of fun with it. The lectures will be mostly on the screen. For that, I apologize. That gives me the opportunity to prepare beforehand and eliminates some fraction of my mistakes. You'll discover that there are lots of mistakes, and it only eliminates some fraction of them. I would appreciate help from you when you see an error. Tell me about it, or tell everybody about it. The text is my book, Statistical Physics. I discovered that I did not refer much to the book when I wrote out these lectures. In fact, I have discovered in many, many years of doing physics that I don't refer much to books at all. Physics has the great virtue that it's expressed in terms of a few equations. And those few equations are all you have to remember. And pretty soon, you think that it's easier to derive things for yourself than to look them up in books. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But there's some need for understanding what conventions. Is it I over H bar, or minus I over H bar, or what on earth do you do? In fact, Wikipedia is very good for that kind of thing. In a minute, you can find out in the most elemental way what people do. You can learn all of the superficial stuff. Deep stuff takes longer and isn't in Wikipedia, but that's okay. I have found Wikipedia to be 100% accurate, or almost 100% accurate, but that's because I believe it. And maybe if people didn't believe it, they would discover it was less accurate. Before I start on anything else, I would like to learn a little bit about you all. Not so much, because I don't have so much time to do it in, but let me start out by asking how many of you have had a graduate course, semester or quarter long, that has the word statistical in the title? How many have had a course in statistical something or others? Come on.
Undergraduate.
Graduate level course in statistical something or other? No courses at all in statistical something or other. OK. I will start from the beginning, because it's conventional to start from the beginning. And in the US, it's distinct from the system of education every place else. In the US system of education, we do everything several different times. exactly whether that's efficient, whether it's sensible, or whether anything, that's, I don't know. But I will start from the very beginning and then tell you what probability is, tell you what statistical mechanics is, and then go on from there to real problems. Let me ask a set of slightly different questions. Let's focus on your undergraduate days. I'd like to know where you all are from. How many of you did your undergraduate work in Africa? Africa. I know how many did undergraduate work in Africa. Okay, let's take, how many did your undergraduate work in Asia? In India as part of that? As China? How many did your undergraduate work in Europe, including Britain, I guess? In Britain is a special case. Britain. In the Americas. North America? Well, almost all hands stay up. South America? You're the Cuban, yes. You were, I don't think you were here when I was last here 3 weeks ago, so nice to meet you. I'm glad that you had the trip to find me. Okay.
Like this board moved
somehow. Okay. Yeah. Let's move it a little bit. Good. Do Cuba in. I'm not going to use it much. I can use this scrap of board also. Okay.
It, yes? From this room, some of us can't see that left scrap of board. Did you use that?
I'll do what I can do. I don't know what I can do. But, everybody can see this okay?
Yes.
Okay. So there's no content to this. This is the course outline. I don't know how closely I will follow it. The first lecture, which is this one, is entitled Once Over Lightly. I will do everything at this very high speed and say what's in the course. Basics come here. What's probability? What's equilibrium statistical mechanics? This is quantum mechanics and lattices. At that point, I will do path integrals in a sort of simple-minded way, and talk about the connection between statistical mechanics and path integrals. How many of you have seen some path integral formulation of quantum mechanics?
All of us.
Okay, how many of you seen it before you got here? That's okay. Bless you, you're a well-educated part. That makes it harder for me, because, of course, the less you know, the more work there is for me, and the easier it is for me to do my work. But that's all right. We'll get through it. In any case, this will be the quantum mechanics and lattices. Pretty soon, we will do some stuff which includes some renormalization here, and start thinking about what happened in the 20th century in statistical mechanics rather than what happened in the late 19th century. Here we start on dynamics. We will look at diffusion as a hopping process. That things that go on all through here are in part about the relationship between continuum stuff and discrete stuff. You all are focusing your attention on the behavior of space. Space is continuous, and that has some very amusing consequences, including, as you heard just a few minutes ago, a whole bunch of infinities that have been bothering people for ages. These infinities are one of the ways of traditionally dealing with these infinities is to do things discreetly with points on a lattice. This work goes back to Boltzmann in the 1880s, who didn't like continuum problems and did most of his stuff discreetly. It continues through some of the quantum gravity work being done here at the Perimeter Institute. And here we will see in these lectures the relationship between continuous and discrete. We will see how one goes up and back from one to the other. So this one starts to be about dynamics and is not not necessarily about Hamiltonian mechanics, and in fact has little Hamiltonian mechanics in it. This fifth set of lectures has stuff about hopping around in momentum space. One of the starts of the present era in physics is Einstein in 1905. One of the pieces of Einstein's work in 1905 was about Brownian motion and about the behavior of momentum as particles are hit by other particles. This is a hopping in momentum space, and we will talk about such hoppings in momentum. The ninth set of lectures. This is my guess for how many lectures will go with each of these topics. This is my guess for how many lectures in all. This is my count of the number of transparencies, of the number of slides, but the number of slides varies some, so you may discover my count isn't so great. In any case, at this stage, we come back to things that many of you know, that is the behavior of degenerate high-density Bose and Fermi systems. To save myself from getting discouraged, I won't ask how many have taken stuff about degenerate Bose and Fermi systems in a course. I will point out, however, that there is some stuff in here and here that I bet, cross my fingers, almost none of you have had. This set of lectures will include stuff which is called the Boltzmann equation. How many of you have seen Boltzmann equation in the course? There you go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Great. This set of lectures will have the application of a Boltzmann equation point of view to degenerate Bose and Fermi systems. How many have seen that? Hey, I won. You got it. Okay. Almost won. So we have application of Boltzmann equation point of view to Bose and Fermi systems. The last pair of lectures will have a different flavor from the first bunch. The stuff here was prepared for you all, as we say down south. These last two have, instead of a teaching flavor, a more of a colloquium historical philosophy of science flavor, since the lecture material was started out as being prepared for a bunch of philosophers, then grew into a history of science paper. And this one is heading in that same direction. We'll see how it goes. It is different in flavor. Is there anything else I want to say? Not much else. Okay. At the head of each one of these sets of lectures, as you find them on your own wiki, is a outline. The outline is just what I copied off of the head of each one of the slides. It differs a little bit since I translated some, and things changed a little bit. But you can get an outline for from that, this is the outline of the present lecture. These are the outlines of the other lectures. Beep, 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 beep. Okay. So this is the outline of the whole blessed course. And now I'm done with part zero, and I go looking for part. Just a pen. I thought I'd drop my batteries, which would have been a pain in the neck. So we go on to the next part. That, what you just saw, is in a part of these notes titled Overview. Now we go back and do fundamentals of statistical physics. This is the course outline, once over lightly. We did that. Okay. More of what I want you to tell me about. What concepts do you think of as being related to statistical physics rather than few particle quantum mechanics or few particle classical mechanics? I started with one, temperature. Give me others, please. Entropy, great. Others?
Density.
I haven't heard you. What? Speak up, please.
Ensemble.
Some rules. What about pressure? Okay. Reaction rates? Chemical potential? All of these are concepts which are completely foreign to classical mechanics, completely foreign to quantum mechanics. They are statistical concepts. Of course, probability is one such statistical concept, foreign to classical mechanics. Classical mechanics tells you exactly what happens. And so when we have a probabilistic interpretation of a wave function, that probabilistic interpretation is in some sense statistical mechanics. Can you think of any others? What about cross? Yes?
Heat.
Heat, great. Others? Free energy, wonderful. What about cross-section? Cross-section is the probability that you get a scattering into some piece of solid angle. That cross-section is also a concept from statistical analysis of what goes on. So what is it used for? Well, let's go on to the next one, which tells you what it's used for. I've got a list here of interesting physical science advances which have a major statistical component. Start from the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of black holes. Move on to the fluctuation spectrum of 3-degree background radiation. In fact, background radiation period plus 3 degrees and fluctuations are all words that are connected with statistical stuff. Bell's theorem, which states that there is a difference between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, is stated in statistical terms. In fact, it must be stated in statistical terms. I'm sort of interested in things related to the sources of complexity in the universe. Those sources, well, first of all, the word complexity is something that is clearly statistical in its meaning, as is the word chaos, or in its perhaps opposite, the word order. All of those things are concepts which are statistical in their nature. If we talk about the probabilities of hearing from civilizations elsewhere in the universe, we are talking about statistical arguments. If we talk about the economics and markets markets are all based upon statistical concepts. In fact, the whole notion of a price is a statistical concept, the notion of equilibrium in a momentary equilibrium in a marketplace. If we talk about time reversal invariance, we're talking about the nature of irreversibility, and we talk about how things look different going forward in time and backward in time. Much of that is talking about irreversibility. People, some people, worry about the probabilities of major Earth-asteroid collisions. To figure out what you want to do about thinking about that, you might want to calculate a probability. You also might want to calculate a probability that what people are saying about global warming has some truth to it. The probability that it has some truth is certainly one. The probability that it's entirely true is zero. And then you have to figure out in more detail what people are saying and what you think about that. Of course, the probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics in terms of wave functions is entirely statistical. The last question, which is, as is our universe likely? Well, it's here, so it probably has a probability one. On the other hand, based upon your view of the basic laws of nature, is likely to have come out that way. Well, that's another question. These are sort of what came to my mind. If you want to add, please do. Don't hesitate to interrupt. Okay. In part two, we're going to start with, in fact, the next slide, not part two, but we'll come back to it. We're going to start with the probabilistic stuff by talking about the behavior of dice. I suspect you all know about the behavior of dice, except perhaps for this behavior, which, as you see, is an amusing spatial property of dice, and why you shouldn't be gambling if people can do that to you. Okay, let's get rid of the amusing spatial property of dice and talk about the basics of probability. Or rather, we will talk about the basics of probability. Philosophers argue about what probability means. I don't understand much about these arguments, but imagine something that happens lots and lots of times uniformly, that is, things aren't changing in time. And imagine that we measure the total number of events. We then divide the events into different categories and label each category with a value of an integer called alpha. The probability that an event of type alpha will come up is the number of events of type alpha that come up divided by n in a limit as n goes to infinity. Of course, it obeys the sum of the probabilities is equal to 1. That's just because alpha lists all possibilities. We'll go on and do this in more detail in a little bit. This is sort of our starting off with probabilities, which I suspect most of you know all about. In the next part, we move on to lattices. Here's a fragment of a slide on the lattices. This is a block spin construction, which enables one to talk about renormalization concepts. Here is some of the talk. And here is late 20th century ideas that come from that talking. That is that you can, as you redefine the size of a block over which you analyze things, as you redefine the spatial scale of your analysis, you can, in fact, redefine the size of the couplings that go into, that goes into your analysis. You have what is called a running coupling constant, which changes between the zeroth step of redefinition or renormalization, the first step, the second, the third, the fourth, and so forth. Here is how you describe a phase transition in terms of such things. And we'll talk about that in detail when we get to it. In part four, we talk about the random walk in space. A walker starts out there and proceeds to hop from lattice site to lattice site. There is a lattice structure underneath this picture. That lattice structure has a lattice spacing about that big. And the walker walks at random in different directions, going this way and this way and this way. Perhaps the walker rolls a four-sided die to choose which direction the walker will go in. And the walker continues to walk through this complicated, or not so complicated, configuration. And we will spend a considerable time analyzing the nature of the configuration, and particularly what happens in the limit as this lattice size goes to zero, or the limit as the number of steps goes to infinity. The fifth part is about the statistics of motion. I've already paid my ritual homage to Einstein. And Einstein talked about how the derivative of momentum with respect to time could be produced by a random force and by a friction. You all ought to know about random forces. And you are likely to get it in quantum field theory and here. So I will, in this part, talk about the effect of random forces and dealing with stochastic motion. Talk about Gaussian random variables. I will talk about how this kind of thing with a set of random kicks and a relaxation in momentum with a time constant tau can together produce the equilibrium statistical mechanics of a Boltzmann distribution. I will then go on, or rather backwards. This is 1905. I'll then go back to 1880 or so and talk about Boltzmann and the Boltzmann equation. The Boltzmann equation has the form shown here. And with the effects of collisions, here's a typical collision. A particle with momentum p comes in, scatters off of a particle with momentum q, and they come out with p prime and q prime. Boltzmann said we should analyze events like this in order to understand how the time derivative of the density of particles with momentum p in the neighborhood of the space-time point RT behaves. And you notice that as in quantum field theory, we have using R and T as a label. In fact, we're using P, R, and T as a label in this Boltzmann equation from 1880-ish. We step forward in time and talk about degenerate Bose and Fermi distributions in part six. This is talking about the symmetry properties of particle wave functions. As you know, for fermions, the wave functions are antisymmetric under the interchange of particles. For bosons, the wave functions are antisymmetric, are symmetric under the interchange of particles. And I thought maybe we could spend just a few seconds talking about what examples were of these different behaviors. For example, I started out for fermion systems with the electrons and atoms. What other fermion systems could we think about? Come on, you guys know other fermion systems. I'm not going to do all the work myself. Really won't. The neutron and the proton, and if we look at a neutron star instead of looking at an atom, we have a good degenerate fermion system. What about? Oh, metals. Metals are a good degenerate fermion system. Okay, let's go on to non-conserved bosons. What bosons do we have that aren't conserved?
Photons.
Photons, you said? Yes, photons and phonons are our two big deal examples of non-conserved bosons. What about conserved bosons? The example I think about, I should have more patience. If I stand here for 30 seconds, you all will come up with your own examples. And I'm told, well, I've watched master teachers in action, and these master teachers could stand there with their mouths closed for 30 seconds, waiting for something to happen. So I should be able to do 10 or 15 seconds anyhow. What about non-conserved bosons? I guess we're in the middle of, we're in the middle of conserved bosons. What conserved boson systems do you think are?
Hydrogen.
That is the hydrogen what?
Atom,
right. Because we have two fermions in it, it behaves like a boson. That's a rather complicated or sophisticated thing to realize that a guy which has things separated by lots of space, or at least in my mind's eye, by lots of space, could nonetheless act in a unified way as a particle which in which the two things are put together, but in fact, it does happen. The example that I think about most is helium-4, because that provides a good superfluid system. And this collection of stuff gives me an opportunity to spend a moment talking about what happens in my own subject of condensed matter physics as distinct from particle physics, cosmology, general relativity, fundamentals of quantum mechanics. Fundamentals of quantum mechanics is sort of closer to what I do, and other subjects which are on the research agenda of the institute here. The advantage of condensed matter physics, and indeed the advantage of much historically of much of the work in statistical physics, is that you have examples in nature that you can almost hold in your hand. That's metal, I'm holding in my hand. You can almost hold in your hand of things which obey the rules you're talking about. The ability to see and work with the things that obey the basic theoretical principles is mighty important, since it's quite easy to get the wrong answers. And if the material, the real thing, is staring you in the face, it will tell you the answer you got is wrong, and you ought to go back and do it again. So in practice, many of the conceptual advances that occurred because the systems at hand were at hand. They were systems you could reach for and work with and do experiments on. And in fact, lots of the conceptual principles used in field theory are the conceptual principles of statistical mechanics and of condensed matter physics. In particular, we then go on to talk about phase transitions. Phase transitions. Here you can see at least three phases of water. There's water vapor up in the air. This iceberg is solid ice, and the ocean down below is liquid. These three phases of matter are behave quite differently. I need only remind you that walking on water is not something that you and I can do, while walking on ice is something that you all can do in the midst of a Canadian winter very easily. In fact, the snowflake, with its beautiful symmetries, has different properties from liquid water, which sloshes all over the place. And we have lost some of the snowflake symmetries when we go into the liquid water. We then can talk about symmetries gained and symmetries lost in the context of things as familiar as water. And when we see a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry in a gauge theory, we then have a familiar old friend, which we know, well, not from the behavior of water, but for the behavior, say, of the XY model of magnetism. Furthermore, there's interesting spatial physics in this. Phase transitions don't happen unless there is some infinity in the system. The difference between liquid water and solid ice is produced only in the limit as the number of particles in the system goes to infinity. And this connection between spatial infinity and qualitative changes in behavior is very interesting and analogous to, in fact, the difficulties that were talked about the infinities in quantum field theory that occur because one has an infinite number of degrees of freedom, both going outward into the universe or inward into the vacuum. On this seventh group of lectures, I'll talk about mean field theory, which is our fundamental way of having learned about the phase transitions. In the eighth group of lectures, I will talk about how mean field theory fails and about the changes that occur because we have to replace mean field theory by other concepts. I will talk about concepts which were developed to describe this because these concepts are broadly applicable. One of the concepts is called universality. That concept is that in different phase transition problems, you can get exactly the same behavior. For example, a liquid gas phase transition is just like the behavior of a certain phase transition in a certain kind of magnet. The word universality, I claim some modest credit for. I borrowed it from two Russian colleagues in a dollar bar in Moscow, brought it west, and then popularized it in our part of the world. The two Russian colleagues were Migdal, the younger Migdal and Polyakov. They are now both here on this continent, and one of them is continuing to work on physics. The other is continuing to work on statistical things by involving himself in markets. The other concept of this last lecture is scale invariance. That is that systems, many systems, look the same as we change the scale of length. In fact, I would argue that physics is all about scale invariance and its failure, or success, but mostly about its failure. That is, physics is about how different systems fit together. Physics is about how classical mechanics works together with quantum mechanics, works together with field theory, works together with string theory, works together, we hope, with applications of general relativity, and about how these things work with each other when we change the scale of things. In this case, the case I just described, is a change in length scale. The one way of doing that is doing stuff called renormalization. Okay, this is the outline of the lecture series. More or less might happen depending on how fast I go, how much you slow me down, how much you speed me up. But this is what we're going to be talking about. You all have questions or comments? Okay. I'm going to talk now about the sort of the most basic calculation in statistical mechanics. You all need a break? Do we want a break? Somebody want to ask for a break? Okay. I'm going to talk about the most basic calculation in statistical mechanics. I will do it off of the slide. Now, have you gotten lectures before off of the screen, or has it always been off the blackboard? I have had only a limited amount of experience working off of the screen. There are problems. I can go using the screen much faster than you can absorb. So I have to try to slow myself down. In addition, the connection between one screen and the next is a pain in the neck, and I'm not exactly sure how to handle it. But let's start out. This is a calculation that many of you know how to do. First error. I put this in myself accidentally yesterday. Let's see if we can use the blackboard a little bit. How many people can't see this blackboard? How many people can't see this blackboard? Everybody can see this blackboard. Fine. We don't need me. We know it's statistical mechanics. Aha, we got a magnet here just to show us about phase transitions. Okay. We start out with a probability. In the logical ordering of things I would have described to you, as I will describe to you in the next piece of stuff, what a probability is. On the other hand, you all know really what a probability is. So let me imagine starting out with a system with a single spin variable, which has a z component which takes on values plus or minus 1. I will, in fact, call this sigma. Now, we all know that the description of a statistical mechanics problem is through a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian, if we have a spin variable and a magnetic field, is the magnetic field times a magnetic moment times the spin variable. Yep. And I'm going to cross off the z's, because I'm just going to call this sigma and not sigma z. And I'm going to call this this z component of the magnetic field, not bz, but simply b. And then we, in general, in statistical mechanics, have something that depends on coordinates and momenta of the particles. which is e to the minus beta h. A spin variable is neither a coordinate nor a momentum. It is an internal variable, but it all works the same way. H depends on sigma. There's the dependence on sigma. And beta is 1 over the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. To simplify the notation from time to time, the B and the Boltzmann constant will disappear. The Boltzmann constant itself will be set equal to 1 using units expressing the temperature and energy units. And often we'll use beta instead of 1 over T. In any case, rho of sigma then, it's up on the slide, is h over kBT with a missing closed parentheses. And except for a normalization factor, except for a factor which describes the overall normalization of the probability, the probability of seeing a spin value sigma is the exponential of mu times B's times B, or we'll call it BZ, times sigma over the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. Thank you. The normalization constant has nothing to do with the z direction. And life is hard. We need more alphabets. Thank you for pointing that out. This z is a normalization constant. This z, which will disappear in just a moment, is a z direction. Thank you. So I make mistakes, sort of mistakes like this all the time. This is a mild one. This is a less mild one, losing this parenthesis. And then there's an occasional conceptual mistake in which I replace I by minus I. And you catch me, but you have to work hard on the conceptual ones. OK. Rho of sigma. The probability of observing a value of sigma is 1 over a normalization constant times an exponential of minus the Hamiltonian over k. T, which is 1 over normalization constant times this exponential. And we'll use as an abbreviation small h for mu times the magnetic field of the z direction divided by the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. There is the probability for observing a spin with value plus or minus 1. If the value is plus 1, the probability is e to the h. If the value is minus 1, the probability is e to the minus h. And both of these should be divided by z. So rho of 1 is 1 over z times exponential of h. Rho of minus 1 is 1 over z times the exponential of minus h. The total probability is 1, which is rho of 1 plus rho of minus 1, which is the sum of all this stuff, so that z is the exponential of h plus the exponential of minus h, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of h. The average of any x which depends on sigma is the sum over any x which depends on anything, is the sum over all possibilities. That's what a sum over alpha is, of the probability of a possibility coming out times the value of x when that possibility comes out. This formula, which looks trivial, is not. And one has to rethink it often. The source of this formula, that the average of x is this sum, is that the average of x is, as an average, it is 1 over the number of cases times the sum over alpha of the number of cases which turn out to be alpha times the value of alpha in those cases, and n alpha over n in the limit of very large numbers is the probability. So we come with that formula. And so the average value of this spin is the probability of observing a spin plus 1 times sigma of plus 1 plus the probability of observing a spin minus 1 times sigma of minus 1, which is 1 over z twice cosine h twice cosh h times the exponential of h minus the exponential of minus h. And that average of sigma is twice the hyperbolic sine of h divided by twice the hyperbolic cosine of h, which entered here, which is the hyperbolic tangent of h. Please?
The exponential of h plus
sine there, that is the, let's do it again. I'm not sure I'm answering the question properly.
It's minus 1.
I have a...
I got it.
That plus sign.
No, no, it's fine. I missed something. I got it. It's multiplying by minus 1.
This time the error was not mine.
It was
but go after me. There are lots and lots and lots of times that the error is mine. So, more than 50% of the time, the error will be mine. So please do go after me. In any case, the average thing is the hyperbolic tangent. This thing results can be understood if we plot. Here is the average spin, which we are plotting against h. And what we want to have is a situation in which the maximum value of the average spin is 1 and the minimum value is minus 1. H is a sort of compressed scale in which the minimum value is minus infinity, the maximum value is plus infinity, and the result looks like that. For strongly negative magnetic fields, or rather, if we go back, that means BZ is the strongly negative values of magnetic field of H, which means positive values of B. No. The spin tends. In any case, for h going to minus infinity, what we have is the average spin going to minus 1. For h going to plus infinity, well, the average spin goes to plus 1, and it's a nice simple curve in between. You all know this much, and there's nothing much to that. May I go on? Somebody want to stop? No. Fine. Now, things are about to happen. Stuff that most of you have seen, but not every one of you. And I would like the tutors to make sure that everybody that hasn't seen this understands it. I want to calculate, first of all, the derivative of z with respect to h. But more importantly, I want to calculate what happens to what happens when we take the derivative of the second derivative of the logarithm of z with respect to h squared. I have to tell you all a little bit about history. That will sort of slow us down and give you time to decide whether or not you understand everything you're looking at. I am a product of the Schwinger school of field theory. I took my quantum mechanics courses all from Julian Schwinger, who, as we heard, was one of the founders of quantum electrodynamics. Now, unlike Feynman, who did things with Feynman diagrams by and large, Schwinger did things with actions and with algebra. Now, one of the reasons that Schwinger, I suspect, that Schwinger didn't use Feynman diagrams is that they were Feynman diagrams. And the physicists, as you know, are rather competitive souls and don't like to give the other guy a break. In fact, in graduate school, I heard a lot about actions and a lot about variational principles involving actions, but practically nothing, essentially nothing, about Feynman diagrams. At the last moment, as I was leaving for my postdoc, one of the guys took me aside and said, hey, you know, in the rest of the world, they use something called Feynman diagrams. Let me spend an hour telling you about what Feynman diagrams are so you can talk to other people. OK. In any case, where I came from, and in fact, in much of modern statistical physics and much of modern particle theory, you use a quantity like Z, we'll talk about it as Z, as a thing that generates all the averages you want to calculate. And there is some advantage to all of this. I'm going to show you, to some extent, how Z works to calculate averages that you need. I would guess 75% of you have seen this, but I would like 100% of you to have seen it recently and remember it. So the calculation, as you have seen already and probably read off of that stuff while I was telling my poor but time-consuming joke, is that Z is the logarithm of the sum.
Wait, Z is the logarithm of that sum?
Sorry, thank you. That's why we do it on transparencies, don't we? Let's wait. OK, so log Z, now you're happy, OK, is the sum of e to the h plus e to the minus h, or it is the logarithm of the sum over sigma of e to the h sigma. Now, what we're going to do in statistical mechanics through the whole shoot and match is we're going to take the logarithm of things like the partition function, and we're going to differentiate it with respect to the important quantities. For example, in this trivial example, we take the derivative with respect to h of the logarithm of z, and we get the sum in the numerator, the sum over sigma, e to the h sigma times sigma. That's the derivative of this thing. And because it's a logarithm, we get a z downstairs. And this is the average value of sigma. So the theorem is that the derivative of the logarithm of z with respect to h is going to be the average value of sigma. In fact, it works out nicely. The logarithm of z is the logarithm of the hyperbolic cosine of h. And the derivative with respect to h of this is going to be the tangent of h. This is the derivative with respect to h of log cosine, log cosh is sinh divided by cosh, and that is hyperbolic tangent. And so that we get this line here. Now comes not fireworks, but just some slightly new result, new for some of you, old hat for others. The second derivative of log z with respect to h is going to turn out to be the average of sigma minus the expectation value of sigma. That means squared. That means the average fluctuations in the value of sigma, which turns out to have the value 1 minus the expectation value of sigma squared, which turns out to have the value, the hyperbolic tangent of h squared. You'll go through this in slightly more detail with the tutors this afternoon. What I should be saying here is that all derivatives of the logarithm of the partition function are thermodynamic functions of some kind. Notice that incorrect plural. I got it before you did. When I get it before you do, you don't score any points. You've got to catch me before I catch myself. All derivatives of the logarithm of the partition function are thermodynamic functions of some kind. As I say below, we expect simple behavior from the logarithm of z, but not from z itself. The derivatives described above, that is, these derivatives, are respectively called the magnetization, m is the average of sigma, and the magnetic susceptibility, chi is dmdh. These are both very important quantities in the behavior of magnetic materials. The derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to beta, 1 over kt, is minus the energy. The next derivative with respect to beta, that is the second derivative, is proportional to the specific heat or heat capacity. That's another traditional thermodynamic quantity. The derivative of the partition function with respect to the volume is the pressure. Okay, homework. Read chapters 1 and 2 in the textbook. Show that the derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to beta is the energy, and the second derivative is the fluctuations of the energy. Next, if, as turns out to be for a non-interacting gas, log z is a constant plus n log volume, omega is the volume, plus n times some a fraction called gamma times log t, with omega being the volume, find the average pressure and its fluctuations. Trivial exercises, but stuff which will make you slightly the wiser. I think we have come to the end of all of this. Let's go on. We've ended the survey. We've ended the introductory discussion. Do you all know what intensive and extensive means in statistical physics? A wise man nodded. Yes, there. Tell us what intensive and extensive means.
The properties of the system that don't depend on how much of the system you have. Intensive property and an extensive property is something that will increase or decrease depending on how much of the physical stuff you have.
Right on. If we have n particles in the system, extensive means that it's a linear function of n. Intensive means that it doesn't depend on n. It would expressed in the sort of in the right way. His definition was in fact better than mine. This is an important distinction. In statistical physics, or at least in equilibrium statistical physics, we're often talking about big, big, big systems, systems containing many particles. This room contains 10 to the 30th particles, or something like that. These big systems, you'll never get them right unless you get understand how things depend on n. That's the starting point of all wisdom in statistical physics. Z itself is proportional I'm going to use a capital Z for the partition function of big systems and a small z for partition function of little systems. capital Z is an exponential of n times something or other. Okay, write it where you can see it. Capital Z is an exponential of n times something or other. This means that capital Z itself is a pain in the neck to work with. If you make the slightest error here, you get all confused about what you're doing. Logarithm of Z is just proportional to n, and is some function of stuff like the ratio of n over the volume, or of the pressure in the system, or of temperature. All of these things are intensive quantities, independent of how big the system is. This leading behavior, this n, is proportional to how big the system is. If you get this structure right, then you're going to understand what it means to differentiate the logarithm of the partition function with respect to any one of these things. And you're going to understand what it means to deal with the big system. Similarly, in field theory, one deals with the logarithm of the action and not the action itself. And the key to that is understanding what these words extensive and intensive mean. Okay, let's start out with the probabilities by just questions, comments. Anybody want to ask about anything?
Yes, please.
Is the log of Z a moment generating function, or is it related in any way to moment generating functions?
Well, these things, okay. Question is, what do the words generating function mean? The words generating function means, roughly speaking, that it is something which you can differentiate to learn about important stuff. In fact, the logarithm of the partition function, as we just said, the logarithm of the partition function has as its first derivative the average with respect to minus beta, the average energy, generating function then for the average energy. The second derivative of the average fluctuations in the energy, mean square fluctuations, or the variance in the energy. Third derivative, if I recall, is proportional to the average of the energy minus the, if I recall correctly, d squared, d cubed, d beta cubed, logarithm of the partition function is equal to minus the average of h minus the average of h, all cubed, and averaged. That is the average skewness, I think it is called, in the energy. The fourth derivative is a more complicated expression. But each and every one of these derivatives has a thermodynamic interpretation. And you will understand the n dependence of everything by understanding that the logarithm of Z is linear in n for large n. In particular, the second derivative, energy minus the average energy, I'll write the average energy as E squared, mean square fluctuations in the energy, that thing is proportional to n. We just understood that because it is the second derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to beta. That means that the fluctuations in energy, that is the typical values of h minus e, the typical values of h minus e are proportional to the square root of n. So sort of the typical of h minus e has as its values. I don't know whether, I don't know what the mathematical symbol is, but the, what it does is it has typical values proportional to n to the 1/2. It is neither intensive nor extensive. It is somewhere in between. However, this says that the fluctuations in energy compared to the energy are small. H minus E over n divided by n is proportional to n to the minus 1/2. That means the fluctuations in the energy are small, and we can talk about the average energy of something without getting messed up with huge fluctuations. So I can tell you that the average energy of the gas in this room is something or other, 10 to the 30th times the 40th of an electron volt, my original estimate of the number of atoms in the room is correct. So it's the order 10 to the minus 29, 10 to the 29. I can tell you that the average energy is that. And I could also say that if you went out to measure it, you would be only making an error of one part in 10 to the 14.5 in doing that, assuming that the temperature in the room was uniform, that I had made a correct estimate of the number of molecules and all. That means the thermodynamics, which is sort of the subject of calculating averages of big systems, is an exact science, even though behind it is statistical mechanics, which says, well, we got fluctuations. Thermodynamics is only right insofar as there are not fluctuations. So the intent, well, so to make the story, a handsome kid. This one doesn't belong to me. To make the story shorter, the idea of intensive and extensive enables us to understand the relationship between two parts of science, between thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. And I claim all of physics is basically about understanding such relationships. That both the relationship is that both statistical mechanics and thermodynamics are correct, even though they sort of contradict each other, since thermodynamics assumes sort of no fluctuations, and statistical mechanics is all about fluctuations. A few little contradictions will not bother a physicist much, or should not bother a physicist much, although will give all kinds of troubles to a philosopher or mathematician. OK, we're done. Time for lunch, or rather, time for lunch. Further questions or comments? OK. Next.